In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
I've heard a lot about you from Steve, and so we're super excited to get talking. Stop yawning.
Don't feel bad. I got a resting bitch face that...
It just doesn't.
I don't know that that's what we call it with Parkinson's, but
Oh, that's what we call it here. Yeah. it makes it funnier than reality. Welcome to The Secret Life of Parkinson's, a podcast created by people living with Parkinson's to help break the stigma of a disease no one likes to talk about. Now, here are your hosts, Jessica Krauser and Brian Baker. All right, well, let's get started. So, Dr. Taylor Rush from Cleveland Clinic. So excited to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us. I'd actually love for you to share with everybody what you do specifically, like not just within psychology, but how it's you're specific to movement disorders, and if you can explain kind of what that looks like from a patient standpoint.
Sure, absolutely. And it's a conversation that I have on a regular basis with patients, because for many of the individuals that I see, they've not met with a psychologist before. Mm-hmm. This is a brand new experience for them. But as many people can attest to, dealing with a chronic neurologic disorder, especially Parkinson's, it's not only physically taxing, it's emotionally challenging as well. It affects every corner of someone's life over time. And so from my end, what I tell individuals is that I want to help you to live better. Mm-hmm. You know, we are only ever guaranteed today, regardless of health status. And so how do we best live today and, you know, hopefully tomorrow in the ways that matter? Because so often life can become an identity of a disorder, right? Because there's medications and visits and, you know, physical therapy and all of these things. And so how do we ensure that there's a quality to your life that is aligned with your values and what's important mm-hmm. to you? And how do you deal with some of the pitfalls that can come along the way of the unexpected, of, you know, issues with mood, with anxiety, of fear of the unknown and uncertainty of the future? So, you know, for me, I see myself as just a companion on this road for people to help them better, you know, feel better equipped to manage what lay ahead.
So do you see people like right away, like when they're first diagnosed, or how do they get to you?
So typically referrals come through the neurologist, mm-hmm. and sometimes we see people right up front as they're diagnosed, and other times we may see them a little bit later in the journey. And oftentimes I may see someone initially within the first year or so of their diagnosis, especially if they're just trying to reconcile what that means for them and their life. And then, you know, they kind of get a handle on things and feel like things are going, you know, smoothly. And then they may develop some symptom progression that then has other impacts on their functionality, on their relationships, at which point they may come back and see me again. And I see individuals surrounding acute events like getting DBS. And we are actually part of that process and ensuring that patients have all the support that they need mm-hmm. through that process with DBS, because it's not a short one. And then, you know, as things progress, we may also then involve care partners in the process as well, and make sure that they're getting all the support that they need as perhaps their role grows over time.
I had a chuckle when she said something about the mood, because right before we started this podcast, I told Jessica, man, I woke up in a grouchy ass mood this morning.
And I did too.
Man, I don't know what it was, but I was just grouchy all morning.
Did you ever see a psychologist when you were diagnosed?
Just when I went to the Cleveland Clinic for DBS.
Okay. So is it not a normal practice that, you know, for Parkinson's patients, that, I mean, what you guys do at the Cleveland Clinic, Is it standard or no? Like to have a psychologist on hand for PD patients?
I would say that our center is unique in that way.
Yeah.
I don't know of many places where psychologists are embedded in a movement disorder center. Mm-hmm. So we are definitely one of the few. There are many movement disorder practices that will affiliate with a psychology department or other practice in order to refer patients. But I literally have one neurologist on this side of me and a neurologist on the other side of me. You know, we practice in a very integrated way to ensure that we are covering all the bases of care for our patients. And it's nice because we have relationships with each other. And so if, you know, Dr. Walter refers a patient to see me, it's not that, oh, you know, I know she's a psychologist, you know, you'll probably do fine. It's no, I work with her every day and I can assure you that, you know, you're in good hands and we work together. And I think that makes a big difference sometimes as to whether or not someone follows up with a referral. And I think it makes a big difference in how we're able to coordinate care.
What are different triggers would you recommend to patients or to caregivers if they recognize or if they experience something, you know, I'm thinking of like hallucinations or, you know, we're talking about dopamine agonists and how, you know, a lot of us have had issues with the addictive behaviors. Like what triggers would you say to like our audience of like, this is a time in which you would want to, advocate for yourself and talk to your neurologist that you do want to see a psychologist?
Depending on the issue that people are experiencing, and there's a wide array, right? So with depression, we can see that occur in upwards of 50% of individuals with Parkinson's. And usually what, in that situation, what I'd say is that if you notice that you aren't quite feeling like yourself, And perhaps you're normally a very gregarious, outgoing person and you are isolating more, or things that you would normally enjoy are not as enjoyable as they used to be. Or you notice that there's just a more persistent sense of sadness or pessimism surrounding your outlook in life. Or one that a lot of people don't equate to depression, but is very common, and especially in men, is irritability. So much shorter fuse than perhaps they used to have.
Like, is that part of apathy or is that like, I mean, I'm assuming it's like all kind of connected, but.
You can have apathy without depression. Okay. And, but often apathy can be part of depression.
Okay.
And that's usually part of my job to tease out with people. But I do have patients who have more pure apathy where there is no distress. And that's the biggest hallmark of what makes it different is that they're like, yeah, I don't care about going golfing or fishing or, you know, socializing like I used to, but I'm good with it. I don't really mind that I don't have that interest anymore. And so that lack of motivation and that lack of interest isn't associated with, you know, feeling discomfort or sadness or distress.
So what do you do for that? Because I know a ton of people, that's one of our biggest topics is like that apathetic feeling.
I think that is honestly one of the hardest things to treat because we're not treating the presence of something. We're trying to treat the absence of something. Mm. And I think that those, what we call as negative symptoms, meaning that there's something that's missing that we would normally expect to see present, like motivation or interest, is not there. And so that can be incredibly difficult to manage. Sometimes there are medications that can help with this, and there's some new ideas about, you know, possible medications that might be able to instigate some sense of interest or energy. On the psychology side of things, we often engage in what we call behavioral activation, which is how do we get you to start warming up to doing things, even if you don't have the interest or wherewithal to want to do it. But how can we set up a situation where you can be supported in doing these things? And then by getting the ball rolling, it then can help them to increase their interest over time. Mm-hmm. So we can sometimes see that can be helpful. So it's, you know, we can't strike while the iron is hot and I'll do this when I'm motivated. It's more, I gotta strike the iron to make it hot kind of situation.
Do you deal with that, with apathy?
I don't acknowledge it if I do, I guess. I don't know.
You what?
I just don't acknowledge it.
I'll acknowledge
if
it.
If I do. I mean, I don't know.
But I'm interested on the irritability thing. So
I'm very irritable.
You're very irritable. And I think this would answer a lot of questions that Melissa always has about you at the gym. So what is it like, what's with the irritability? You mentioned it, you know, it's mostly seen in men, you know, with Parkinson's. Is that right?
We can often see that be associated with depression more in men than when in women. Mm-hmm. It's not a, you know, hard and fast rule, but in generalities, it can be the case. And there are different reasons for that. For one, it may be that there is some less in motivation or interest in things. And so when people are prodding someone to, you know, do something, encouraging them to do something, it feels overwhelming because they feel like they're trying to pull from an empty well.
Yeah.
And so it's like, just back off. I don't need this right now. And so they may act a bit more prickly. In other situations, there's an internal dialogue of, I should be able to do things the way that I used to. I should be able to, you know, get things done without having to think so much about it. You know, 5 years ago, I did things this way and now I can't. And so there's an irritability associated with the mismatch of expectations with reality. And that can definitely cause irritability that becomes externalized, because then they think often that other people are judging them in the same ways that they're judging themselves.
Yes.
What?
What she said.
I'm not judging you.
All the time.
Sit up.
You can't speak right. You can't do this right. You can't do that right.
Well, you only see me once a month, so it's fine. But we actually were talking about something like that a couple episodes ago of, you know, people being able to actually accept that it's not that we can't do the same things. We just have to maybe do them differently or, you know, shift that focus. But there are the people that don't think that way are probably the ones that get stuck in that irritability like situation. What any recommendations that you would have for like a caregiver who is dealing with the irritable person of how they should act, I guess?
I see that dynamic often, and I work with caregivers quite a bit to kind of coach them on how to navigate that. And sometimes that's talking to them by themselves, or sometimes it's talking to them with their loved ones so that everyone can be on the same page. And so, you know, depending on the situation, so what you just mentioned a few minutes ago with, you know, Steve Hurst saying, oh, sit up straight, you know, you need to, you know, speak louder, you know, doing all these little things. And it may be out of the best of intentions, right? Because your loved ones want you to work on things that can be worked on. They want you to be okay. And so they often feel somewhat helpless in that process, other than providing these prompts or reminders mm-hmm. to do things. And so for them, they see it as one of the few ways that they can help. And so they tend to use it often. And while on the other hand, the person with Parkinson's is then like, oh my gosh, I wish they would just get off my back already. Mm-hmm. And so it creates this contentious dynamic. So one thing that we'll talk about is how to create some shared expectations. Mm-hmm. So one thing is, you know, obviously with Parkinson's, you may move a little bit more slowly and you may have to do things differently. As a care partner, don't swoop in and do it for them with the assumption that they want you to do it just to get it done. Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing that I'll often recommend, because they'll say, oh gosh, they're really struggling to, you know, tie their shoes or button these buttons. And so I just, you know, I wanted to make it easier for them, when really, you know, they would have preferred to do it by themselves, even if it took a little longer. So how do we create a shared expectation that unless I ask for help, let me do it and we'll allocate a few more minutes mm-hmm. to make sure that it gets done. But then in situations where I do want help, I'm going to ask you for mm-hmm. that help. And I promise I will ask, because I think that's often caregivers' concern, is that their loved one won't ask. Mm-hmm. And so how do we make sure that we're in agreement that you will ask when you need help, and then also that the caregiver will be a little bit more hands-off when they don't need help?
Maybe that's the conversation I feel like I need to have at home.
Oh. I thought you meant with me. I was
no.
like,
oh, No, because like I remember when Ruth came on as the caregiver, she brought that up, and because she said, you know, one of the things that she learned over time with her husband who has Parkinson's was, you know, she would try and do that. You know, she would finish a sentence for him, or she would, you know, whatever. And finally, like, he told her, like, I want to try and do it myself. Like, you know, so she's like, so I let him. She's like, and I didn't realize that that was like such a big issue. Whereas like, I'm on the flip side, and I'm like, because I don't know if it's just because of like everyone's personality is different, but I'm used to doing, you know, everything in the house, you know, not everything.
Derek Sorry, does it's just nothing.
Yeah, no. Derek does a ton. The kids really do help out, but it's just a motherly thing. You're like, there's so much that we do that, you know, whatever, just goes unnoticed a lot. But there's a lot of times that I'm like, I just wish somebody would just say like, oh, let me do that. Like when I'm cooking or like cutting, you know, cutting the meat, which is starting to get really annoying, being able to try and do. But, you know, it's like, I want somebody just to step in, cause I do ask for help, but it's like, sometimes I don't want to, cause then I don't know. It's weird.
No, I do the same thing. Cause there's stuff like around yard work. And so, yeah, where I used to enjoy that stuff, but there's times now where I just don't feel like doing it. I'm waiting for my son to say, Dad, let me go mow the yard for you today. Or, hey, Dad, the grass is getting long. I think I'll jump out there and mow it.
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't do it.
Maybe someday.
You know, we sometimes, you know, are looking for support in ways that we hope our loved ones will implicitly notice. And it's an unfortunate fact that no matter how long you've been with someone, you know, that they're probably not going to be able to read your mind. And so being able to ask for that help, I think, is important. But then also thinking about what are ways in which I would appreciate, you know, support be given just on a regular basis? What is something that I feel like I need? And that ends up being part of a larger conversation that I will often see in families surrounding, again, expectations as well as support. And a lot of that ends up getting rooted down into what are some of those emotional needs as well? Because yes, there are things that you might be able to do, but it takes so much longer. So there's, you know, we talk about like the five love languages and acts of service. Like that ends up being a way that you feel like people can show that they care, because that's the way that you may show that you care. Mm-hmm. And so how do you end up meeting each other's emotional needs? Starts with also having emotional conversations. Like, I feel like people don't quite understand how difficult this is and how hard my days are. Mm-hmm. I don't think people understand how fatigued I get by the time it's noon. I you know, and it's frustrating, and sometimes it feels rather isolating, or, you know, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that you then blame that person for the feelings that you're having, but more so just making sure that everyone's aware of what's going on in each other's heads. Mm-hmm. Because I think so often people end up refraining from talking about how they really feel because they think they're sparing their loved ones. Mm-hmm. When in fact, it's really not doing anyone any justice.
Yeah. It's a really good way to think about it. I know there's been like a lot of, not discussion. I mean, I just feel like there's a lot in the news right now, about with when it comes to Parkinson's, about, hallucinations and like the psychosis. And we did have a episode, with a college friend of mine. I think that we may have interviewed her a year or two ago. Her mom had dealt with.
Now at Menards, save big money on everything for your next project. Shop our huge selection of concrete, from general purpose concrete to specialty sand and mortar mixes. We have what you need to get any job done right. View our entire selection online or in store today and save big money. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Psychosis, Parkinson's psychosis. Is that something, again, like that you help them manage through? Is it through medication and through, like, you know, what does that look like? Or what should people be aware of?
So you're right, you know, there's a lot out there right now looking at Parkinson's psychosis and, you know, treatments for that. And I think a lot of times people may not mention it in the milder stages unless very specifically asked by their neurologist. They may, it may start off as more illusions where people see a coat rack and they think it's a person, or they feel like they see a shadow moving out of the corner of their eye. And so they just kind of brush it off and move on. And then the hallucinations may become a bit more well-formed. And it's only until, you know, they either are asked about it, or maybe their loved one notices that, hey, they're looking very distracted by, you know, a point of nothing on the floor, or, you know, and so they, until inquired about, they may not mention it. So I would suggest that at the earliest sign of noticing any of those visual misperceptions or hallucinations, to talk to your neurologist about it. Because in some cases, you know, we know that hallucinations actually happen acutely in situations where people may have a urinary tract infection or some other systemic infection, or sometimes their medication is too high. And so there are other reasons that can be directly addressed that can help to eliminate the hallucinations.
Okay. So and then it's not just, it's not always just like because of the Parkinson's disease, it's other things that can, okay.
Correct. So it's always a good idea to find out, because there may be other reasons that can be very easily addressed to help to diminish them quickly. And then for others that are a little bit more slow forming over time, again, letting your neurologist know, because again, it may inform them as to how they want to change medication or any additions that could be given to help with management of hallucinations. There are some medications mm-hmm. that can be incredibly effective with this. It doesn't always make them go away completely, but it can make them much more intermittent mm-hmm. and make sure that they don't necessarily progress to a point of being very distressing. And on the behavioral side of things, you know, I'll often talk to people about this and how to better interact is the best word with the hallucinations, or not interact with them. And so how to do some reality testing around, okay, is this something that's really here versus not, in terms of checking with loved ones, or, you know, if I ignore it, does it go away? How do I, and as caregivers, you know, how do mm-hmm. I support my loved one who's having hallucinations? And so it's often being very calm, very, you know, nonchalant about it, because if you get distressed, then your loved one gets distressed. And truly with hallucinations, it's something that your brain is producing and, you know, you are seeing. So it's not, you know, it's not so easy as just saying, oh, it's just, you know, just this random thing. So I'm just going to ignore it now. Sometimes it's much harder than that. And so to have the right support around you and people being encouraging and calm rather than, you know, getting reactive or distressed helps a great deal.
Is there a certain time, like within the progression, that you typically see people dealing with hallucinations?
There's no specific likelihood of onset. Okay. Some of it depends on when someone was diagnosed. If they're younger versus if they're older, sometimes we can see it happen more quickly in people who are older. But usually it's not something we necessarily expect to see until maybe, again, rough estimate, you know, years, you know, somewhere between 5 to 7 through 10.
And is it, how typical is it? Like how many, like what percentage of Parkinson's patients actually experience this?
It's roughly 50%.
Oh, shit.
Flip a coin.
I know. That's just.
Yeah, but I mean, but didn't you say early on you started having seen.
I thought I would, like, but I was, I don't, I mean, who knows?
I do the same thing. Like, I think I'm like, did I think I saw that, or did I just. Like, am I having a hallucination?
I know. No. And I don't think mine was, but it's so weird either. Because I do remember thinking of it as like a shadow, or like a silhouette or something, but
our brain can play tricks on us, you know, and it's just those visual misperceptions that we think is playing a role in the occipital lobe where we get some of our sight information from. And so it's truly just kind of how our brain is perceiving things. It's often more in lower lighting. So, and that's why people seem to have it more in the evening, because there's more shadow, there's less light. It's mm-hmm. harder to discern things.
Is there, like once you start having like hallucinations because of not maybe, you know, it's not because of medication, but because of the disease. Can it go away? On like Brian and I always talk about like, well, for like a whole year, my shoulder was in pain. And then, you know, it's after doing some things that like it went away. Like, do hallucinations ever go away on their own? Or once you have them, you have them?
When it's part of the progression of Parkinson's rather than medication induced mm-hmm. or infection related or something like that, I don't often see them go away completely. Okay. They often just become much more mild, less frequent, and less intrusive. And so they may, you know, say, oh, you know, I see something here and there every once in a while, but I know it's nothing and I can just kind of wave it off. So really the goal a lot of times with medication management and behavioral management is how can we make sure they're the least amount intrusive and distressing as possible? Mm-hmm.
Sorry, did you say, I thought you were going to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I'm taking it all in.
Taking it all in. Some things we might be having to look forward to.
So how do you know when it's time to get like on an antidepressant or a drug?
I mean,
is there a time? Is there certain things that?
Are you on one?
No, I mean, I don't take them. That count. I'm non-compliant. I've been told. No, I tried them, and I didn't see any difference. And I'm like, I don't know why I'm taking this pill. It's not doing anything for me.
How long you tried to let it work?
I'd say probably about a year.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't know. Yeah. I guess I didn't believe I needed it to begin with. So there was that kind of thing. And then I had such a small dose. Like my medical friends were like laughing. They're like, Brian, that's like a baby dose. That's, you know, so that's doing absolutely nothing for you. So there was that too.
Yeah. So you're on like a baby aspirin dose, basically.
That's what I was going to say.
Like a 5 milligram.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, one thing I would say is that when you have that conversation with your provider, whether it's your movement disorder neurologist or even primary care provider, whomever it may be, you know, I think when is the right time to go on? It really depends on the person. But I would say when it is starting to interfere with things, when depression or anxiety is starting to interfere with how you're able to go about your day, how well you're able to sleep, how it may be taking a toll on your relationships, when it is creating some functional issues in your life, that is a good time to consider being on medication. The other thing is that, you know, they usually do start you off on very small doses because we don't want you to be on more medication than you need to be. So they usually start off at a very conservative dose just to get your body introduced to the medication and to lessen the likelihood of side effects. And then once you're on a lower dose for usually somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks, then they may start to up the ante a little bit with the dosage until we can reach something that's more therapeutic. And so if at first you don't succeed, it's definitely a try again situation.
So with like thinking about mental health, you know, in general of how it's discussed, you know, with or without Parkinson's, but with Parkinson's specifically, like, do you see, I mean, I know we see depression, anxiety, you know, and apathy are like really big. Do people then let it get so, like, does it get so bad that the people might become suicidal? Like, do you see that at all, like with people with Parkinson's or movement disorders?
I do. It's a small subset of individuals. And for many of them, not all, but for many of them, it's because depression has already been somewhat of a lifelong struggle. Okay. And they may have already dealt with suicidal thoughts in the past. And now when you add a neurologic condition like Parkinson's, it adds fuel to the fire, feeling helpless, of feeling like, you know, there's nothing I can do to make my life better, I feelings of worthlessness. And so it then compounds the situation dramatically.
To me, isn't some type of suicidal thoughts almost common for somebody that's been diagnosed with a non-curable degenerative disease?
I mean,
just to have the thoughts like, and I say it all the time, like when I can't take care of myself, I don't want to be around.
I know, but would you really do that? Like, I know you say,
yeah, go in the garage and turn the car on, but I don't think I'm depressed. I don't think I'm like, hey, when I get to the point where I have to have somebody, you know, feed me and have to have somebody, you know, give me a shower. And so I'm like, that's a quality of life thing. And I don't want to live like that.
So as a mental health professional, I would not categorize that as a suicidal thought.
Okay.
That's more of a future projection. What may life look like in the future?
Right.
And what are ways that I can try to stay in control? That's how I interpret that.
Great. I'm not suicidal.
No, you're not.
You're not suicidal.
You might need a therapist.
I probably do need a therapist.
And I will also have patients who, you know, they are not actively suicidal. They're not making a plan to end their life, but they do have what we call passive suicidal thoughts, which is more, look, if I don't wake up tomorrow, I'm not going to argue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if things ended, then so be it. You know, I'm not going to do anything to actively take my life, but I'm not necessarily going to be upset if it ends.
Mm-hmm.
And just because they often find that, you know, if this is exactly the way life is going to be in the future or worse, I don't know how to envision that.
Mm. It's like I can't imagine. You know,
but those are all very good reasons, again, to see a psychologist or a mental health professional. If you notice that you are having those thoughts, those are all very good reasons to talk to someone about them.
Or just to talk through it, to make sense of it. Like, you know, to your point, it's like, that's not an active suicidal thought. You know, it's just a, you know, vision of the future. I don't know. Yeah. That's a lot to take in.
One of the biggest things that I see as a protective factor for mental health is connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as humans, we are very much hardwired to be connected to others. And sometimes with Parkinson's, people feel less connected and they may withdraw sometimes from social connection, either because they think, gosh, I don't want other people to see me with symptoms, so I'm not going to go out because, you know, my tremor is acting up or my gait is a bit off. And so, you know, I just rather them not see me this way. Or, you know, it's very loud or crowded in some of these places, and so I don't want to go for risk of, you know, having an accident of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so there can be some insidious ways that disconnection occurs. And so I will often ask people to stay very aware of how they're connecting to people and to make sure that they are. Because it's not that you need a robust social network of, you know, 100 people, but just really making sure that you're carefully curating those relationships that matter to you, because that ends up making the world of difference in terms of quality of life and support.
Because there's actual research studies, I believe, that I've read of how socializing is almost just as critical of slowing the progression, like exercises, right? There's a lot out there, isn't there?
Yeah, there's definitely some relevant to the PD community, and then at large, there's a ton of research on that.
Yeah.
And so we know that this is important. And so, you know, failure to thrive, so to speak, isn't just something that happens in babies. It happens with us as adults too.
Yeah.
And so we really have to make sure that those connections don't wither away.
Yeah.
More game nights.
More game nights. Aren't you glad we're friends?
Yep.
Do you see a difference with people who have a, you know, just a regular social group versus a Parkinson's social group?
I will often see that the people who thrive the best have both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So they have support that is, you know, within their family or their community or their church or their volunteer group or whatever it may be. But then if they have a subset of support through a Parkinson's support mechanism, so it might be a community support group or an exercise class or whatever it may be, it's a subset of individuals who know exactly what they're going through because they're going through it too.
Yeah.
And I think that level of validation and being seen is so incredibly important in order to realize that you're really not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have the best support in the world from your family and friends, and that's important. But to have people who really get it makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've I've said this a lot in the past where, like, with her husband, Derek, I'm like, when Jess says, hey, I'm having a bad day, like you said, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, as much as he wants to understand,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you, unless you're there, you don't understand.
Yeah. Same thing with, like, you know, when I talk to, like, my mom or my friends and they're like, well, you know, just, like, tell me about it. It's like, I can, but then you're going to, like, ask me questions and it's not relevant and it doesn't make sense. And it's like versus telling somebody else who has it and they'll, like, just, you know.
It's shorthand. You don't have to explain it in full length.
Yeah.
You know, they get it in a few short descriptive words. And because sometimes you just don't have the energy or the time to really get into it in that in that way. So it's important to have a few shorthand friends.
Yeah. Or short friends.
Yeah.
Well, Taylor, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. This was really good, in-depth conversation on just overall Parkinson's mental health that I know we need to talk about more because it's, you know, half of the symptoms that we're dealing with. You know, we talk a lot about all the other, you know, physical symptoms that everybody can see, but this is something that, I mean, it hits home for a lot of people in all the different phases and stages of this disease progression. So really appreciate your time. And I hope everybody learned something. I know I did. So
thank you so much.
All right. In our last 30 seconds, I will leave you with this. If you haven't yet already, check out with your doctor, your neurologist, your hospital to see if there is a psychologist that you can talk to. If you think there is, if there's a need to be honest, I think everybody should at least try it out, check it out, talk to somebody, but share the information in terms of what you're feeling, what you're going through, because no matter what, this journey is not easy, but you are not alone. So please make sure that you advocate for yourself and reach out as necessary. And with that, we'll see you next time. The Secret Life of Parkinson's is produced by Melissa Carlson and Steve Brandenburg. To contact us, email info@thesecretlifeofpd.org. The Secret Life of Parkinson's is not responsible or liable for any medical advice, diagnosis, course of treatment, or any other information obtained through this podcast. The information provided by The Secret Life of Parkinson's is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you heard on this podcast. You are encouraged to consult a physician for a definitive diagnosis.
Are you looking for legit ways to make extra money? Our friends at The Side Hustle Show have put together this cool free 60-second quiz to help you do just that. All you got to do is go to hustle.show. You can do it right from your phone. Answer a few short multiple choice questions, and it'll recommend a few episodes of the hit Side Hustle Show podcast to start with. You can add your personalized Side Hustle Show playlist to your device, learn what works, and start making more money today. Again, that's at hustle.show or follow the award-winning Side Hustle Show in your favorite podcast app.